på streamen og sett hvordan dette blir, blir sendes ut nå. Og ikke minst hvordan det høres ut.
Hello, good morning. How's the sound quality? That was weird hearing myself. Okay, then don't worry about it. I'll come and scream if it breaks down. Is the picture showing there, or should we turn a little bit? You see here? Okay, that let's try. Okay. Thank you, Carl. Good morning, and welcome to IMT 4116 again, reverse engineering and malware analysis. Before we start on chapter 7 today, analyzing malicious Windows programs, two words about the assignment. I have not received any cries for help, so then I'm assuming that you're okay, but talking to some people in the classroom, that might not be the case. I just want to, for everybody that listens, make sure you understand what the assignment should focus on. In class last time, Kato went through a long procedure getting from a document to a PE file. And that PE file is called a dropper. That's the functionality of the PE file that we eventually got to. If you want to repeat everything he did up until we got to this point, that's optional. It's good training, but that's not part of the assignment. But if you do, I don't mind if you include it in the assignment. But that's optional. So when we have this, what I expect this to do, I explained to somebody, there's a difference between these two terms, a dropper and a downloader. The purpose of both of these is to get the intended malware onto your computer, onto your system. The difference here, at least theoretical difference, there might be people that do it, but the theoretical difference is the downloader is just a small piece of code that connects to the internet and downloads additional malware. So it doesn't contain the actual malware that it wants on your computer. A dropper has similar functionality, but the malware is already in the code somewhere, hidden. So when you run a dropper, it unpacks or decrypts or retrieves the actual malware from somewhere hidden inside here and places it on your computer, and that malware is the intended malware. For the assignment, you are asked to analyze the dropper, not the file that it unpacks. And these words are, from what you get here is a dropped file. So the dropper will give you a dropped file. Don't worry about this right now. The first task is to get this to run and make it drop this file. But that is just to see some of the functionality of this. Analyze this and describe this in assignment one. This one, have a look at it if you want, but you might be getting a head start on assignment two. Because if I understood Kato correctly, unless he changes his mind, he wanted to do this in assignment one to show that it drops a file, and then he wants to show you how to analyze and figure this one out in step two. So this, we're looking at this as assignment two. That's at least how we're thinking now. I'll talk a little bit more to Cato. So if you find it difficult to analyze this, then yes, that's correct. It is difficult. So focus here. Any questions in the room here or online about that? I be honest with you, the question was how many pages do I expect for the assignment? But to be quite honest, I have absolutely no idea. This is the first time I do. But I do expect to see an effort on basic static analysis, basic dynamic, if that makes sense, and also reading the assembly code or digging into IDA Pro and trying to recognize, find some of the IOCs that we described. But to be quite honest, I have absolutely no idea how difficult this task is for you. It's the first time I do. I haven't seen this code before. It's Kato's, I would blame him if it's too difficult. So this is Sediment Dump. You are my guinea pigs. It's a pass and a fail. I will fail you if I clearly see that you have ignored the assignment and haven't given it a try. Honest attempt, then you're good to go. I just need to make sure that you're not completely ignoring this course and can't follow the rest of the course and are completely lost when we get there. That's the best answer I can give. I probably told everybody they don't have to do anything, but that's not correct. So don't read it as that. This is how you learn. The payback is during the exam or afterwards when you have to use this. So, all right, god oppklaring. Good, Bjørge is happy. Anything else about the assignment? Good. Please, last thing I'm going to say about the assignment is that I posted Kato's email on Blackboard. Use it, but don't wait until the last day because he needs time to answer. He might not have the time to answer you the minute you send it. All right. Over to today's lecture, chapter 7 in the book. This might or might not be helpful for the PE file, but it's definitely helpful if you're analyzing malicious Windows program at the later stage. So why we have a whole chapter on Windows? Most malware, at least the majority, is runs on Windows platform and are actually PE32. I mentioned this before. Malware that wants to have hit as many as possible will do PE32 because they also run on 64-bit machines. So we're going to look at the Windows coding concept. And why are we doing this? Because we have a hypothesis that the non-malicious writer are better at following this than the malicious writer. That we will find deviations in malware that we, or more frequently than we do in non-malicious, and that's what we need. That's what we need to separate this. So this chapter is about see if we can recognize or learn some of the techniques or concepts in Windows and see use that to detect unexpected use of the functionality. So that includes the Windows API terminology, how malware can modify the host system. The book also says that we're going to look at how to create host-based signatures, which I also asked you to do in the assignment. I'm putting parentheses around it because it's not clear. There's not a separate chapter that deals with that. It's more indications in every IOCs here and there and little things that can be used. So if you're looking for a separate chapter focused on that, you won't find it. We're going to look at execution outside the file and kernel mode. Huge topic. We'll briefly touch it, and we'll see if we can back to it more in later chapters. If not, I kernel mode is probably enough for a whole nother class. So, the Application Programming Interface, Windows API. This is functionalities that then tells you how to interact with the numerous libraries that Windows provide. And when you read this, there's a known terminology called Hungarian notation. I copied a table from the book in here, and where they explain a few of them, but it's the little letters in the parentheses that you will find when you read code. So if you see a W before some kind of word, no, that was a double meaning, but then it's a word. If DW, then it's a double word. If you see H, it's a handle. LP, long pointer, and so forth. There's more, but this is some of them. So that's the Hungarian notation. Is just little letters like that that indicates what the meaning of different terms in the code is. Okay. Then you're going to come across handles. When you have items that has been opened in the operating systems, in the operating system, Windows, processes, modules, menus, files, etc. You need something that you can so you can refer to this, and that's what handles are for. They're almost like pointers, and refer to object or memory location. But unlike pointers, they cannot be used in arithmetic operations, and they're not always referring to the address. And basically what you do is you when you open or create something like this, a module, menu, file, whatever, you create a handle and you store it, and when you want to refer to that object later, you use it. So for example, create Windows, then you get a handle back called HWND. And if you want to do anything with that window later, like destroy it, then you need to use the handle to get to that that window. Then we have a lot of functions that go on the file system. And malware very often create or modify files. These are great if you can find a unique file name that is created or modified. You can that's a great host based signature. And then you have the function calls create file. For create and open, read file, these are self-explanatory, read and write. Then you have create file mapping and map view of file. Might be an F too many in there. The book is correct. This loads file from disk into memory. And then you get a pointer for where it's loaded. And this allows you to manipulate and maneuver through the file much more flexible than if you use read-write up here. And if you see this, this might be a program that wants to parse through a file looking for something particular. So these are the function calls that you need to recognize or understand when you read the code and understand what they're for and what possibility opens up for the malware. We have some special files in Windows that are not accessible the way normal files are accessible, not by the driver and folder. And they don't show up in the directory listing. And this, of course, is a great tool for the malware writers, because then they can try to hide their files. They also provide some greater access to hardware internal data, and you can also use them in expressions and manipulated. Shared files looks like this. I never remember if it's slash or backslash, but you'll see what it is. But server name and then share. That's one way of doing this. Then you have namespaces where you have special folders like this. For example, if you write this physical disk 1, then you have direct access to the physical disk, and you can do a whole lot that might mess up your system. And malware writers can use this to either hide things, or they can, of course, use it to destroy things or make trouble for you if that's their objective. In the book, there's a reference to Wittyworm that wrote to a random space on the disk using that namespace right there. You can also modify the kernel and hide programs. At least you could before 2003. And also that note at the bottom there is mine. Yes, this is what the book says is possible in 2012. I'm not sure what has happened, or if things have been more restricted since 2012. But try it out and you'll find out. And if you see this type of writing, then you know it's about shared files and namespaces, and it might be used to hide things from plain view. Next, we have Altnet Data Streams, ADS. That's a feature that where you can attach additional data to the files that are visible. And this does not show up in the directory listing or when you display the file. But it shows up if you show the stream. So it's the normal file name here, let's say .txt, and then a colon, and then stream, and the data behind there. And then you can store whatever you want there. And that is, of course, popular because it's a good way of hiding data, at least from inexperienced analysts. Should be easy to try out. Just try to store some data yourself as a stream behind a normal file and see if you can see what it looks like. I'm sorry, I forgot to drink my coffee before I started today. So unless you want me to fall asleep, I need to. Windows Registry. This is... I don't know if any of you were ever looked at when it was the .ini files, but that this is the former .ini files or similar to that. And it basically stores the operating system and program configuration information, networking, drivers, startup, etc. And what the malware use of this is especially persistence. Make sure the malware starts up again when you reboot the system, but also to find system configuration. They want to harvest as much information as they can from the system. This is you can find a lot in the registry, but they can also create the configuration, so alter this in the way they want. For example, to create persistence. Registry has a strict structure with a root key, H key or hive, and then it's a sub key, and value. and there are five root keys. One that is global to the machine, one that is specific to the current user, one that defines types, one that deals with the hardware configuration, and one for default or new users, or sometimes the current user. Where you find different things that are interesting is something that comes with experience. But I want you to pay attention to this one. This key is frequently used to achieve persistence. And I see that I forgot to translate that. So, used by malware to achieve persistence, for those that can't read Norwegian. Sorry about that. Because this key is about, this is the auto-run list, what starts when automatically when you start the machine. There's a tool, auto-runs, that can list this code, so try that out. There's also regedit would also be helpful. So what to look for in a malware? Look for functions or API calls that has to do with the registry. So opening it for editing and acquiring, add new value, or return value. And if you see any of these, then it's worth looking into it and see, okay, what is it they're actually doing? It might not be malicious, it could be quite normal, but these are things that I will look into. And there's an example in the book. Let's see if we can understand what's going on. In the beginning here, you see push. So certain values are pushed onto the stack, whatever the function call needs. We're used to that. That's how it works. And then we get a function call here to reg open key. So that means that we open a handle to the key, the specific key that we want to look at. And the key here is, looks like it's the run key. Maybe this has to do with persistence. This one returns the handle in EAX. And then further down here you get the size. You push some things on the stack again, and then you get the size of the data. And then what you're doing down here is basically providing parameters for the run key, different settings here, and let's see if we can find where EAX is. Does anybody see it? But that is the this is the get the size. So we need it should be the same in here. Is it this one? Well, I need to look at that. But the point there is that to analyze this in detail, you need to look up the reg set value function call and see what the inputs are. And all these push values here are the values that are needed in this function. And from the, I'm moving out of the picture if I go out there. So we need to find out what is it actually doing here. We can guess that it's creating persistence by adding a value to the run key. If you're going to confirm that, you need to find out which of these values will actually make something run. Yeah, that's as far as I can go right now. But then we need to look at the different lines here. Do you understand the procedure? Nodding, so okay. Again, don't get lost in the details, but understand the big picture. You see something open, get a handle to a register key, checking the size of the data. They're providing a lot of data on the stack, and then they call reg set value that sets a new value or creates a new key. Then it's interesting to go back and see what happened there. Okay. Next, we have APIs for networking, and then we'll refer back to the cyber kill chain, and also to what we talked about, the downloader. You need to communicate to the network for several reasons. The malware might download additional malware, as the downloader would do. Command and control, receive commands. Or the malware has found something that wants to upload to a server somewhere, steal information, for example. So this is important functionality for malware, and there are different ways of doing it. And what you need to be able to do is recognize when the malware connects to the internet. And this will provide you with not only better understanding what's going on, but also allows you to write network signatures. And that is part of chapter 14 in the book. So, first way, Berkeley-compatible sockets, almost identical in both Windows and Unix. The DLL you're looking for is VS232 DLL. If you see that one, then at least they have the library to do this. And in the book, there's a list of the most common functions needed to do this. Socket, bind, listen, accept, connect, receive, and send. A bit of analysis tip. If you're looking for this, look for WSA startup and set a breakpoint there, because this is called before networking functions. So if you're looking to find out how does it connect to the internet, then start. That's a good starting point. I think breakpoints and is part of the next lecture, not next week, because then there won't be any teaching, but the week after. Then the teaching assistant, Sergei, will talk about stepping through the code and setting breakpoints. This way of doing it has a server and client side. Just remember that the malware can be either side. The server side is the one that opens and maintains the socket and waits for incoming calls. And what you're going to look for, if you look for a server-side application, is the following words: socket, bind, listen, accept, in order. And then after that, you will have send and receive as necessary, depending on the connection. So that's when you look on the server side. On the client side, it will connect to a server. And what you're looking for is socket, connect, in order, and then send and receive as necessary. Just be aware, and as with many things in this class, just because you see this doesn't mean it's malicious. It's also legitimate uses of this. So let's see if we can what it looks like in an example. I can't reach up, but if you see up there, you see the WSA startup. Good place to start. Search for that. And then we see socket, bind, and socket, bind, listen, accept. Socket, bind, listen, accept in order. So this is server side. So if you couldn't read the one down there, this is what you're supposed to get in your analysis. Everything in between here, as we're used to know, when there's a call to a function, what's in front is the prologue, push the things on the stack. So if you're interested in what goes into the function, that's where you have to look. No questions online yet. Then there's a second second method of connecting to the internet. This is the WinINet API, higher level than the Windows socket. Look for the WinINet DLL. If that's imported, then this might be used to implement higher level protocols. And the function calls that you look for, the API call that you look for, is Internet Open. Internet open URL or internet read file. If you see that, then it's worth looking into what is this program using the internet connection for. Good so far? Are these things that you've had in different classes, or is this completely new to you? Mangalabna. In this class already. Okay, just repeat that online. This has been already been in lots of the labs in this class. Good. So that's this. So that next year I can skip this lecture. That's what you say. First time following the book, so I'm learning as we go. Okay, this next section here is following the running malware. Any code that executes, you need to transfer execution to different places of the code. That's how you make the code live and work, and not just a sequential list of instructions that you execute. This, of course, can be done with jump instructions, and it can be done by calling functions. But we're going to go through 2, 4, 6, 7 different ways of transferring the execution somewhere else. DLL, that's by far the most common way. Processes, threads, mutex, services, component, object model, and exception handling. And some of this is probably familiar to then when you work through the labs. Little repetition can't hurt you. So DLLs, that's how Windows make available functions for programs that are used by multiple applications. And when you open it, you will see that these programs export functions rather than importing a function. And these are what we find in the import in regular code. Very similar to exe files. There's actually just one flag that tells you whether it's an exe or a DLL. But as you already know, more exports, less imports. So how do the malware authors use this? One that I don't know if you've seen in a lab so far, but storing malicious code in the DLL will be a great way, because then all programs that use that DLL will be exposed to that malware. Has that been in the lab yet? It will. If not, they will come. I know there's a lab that shows that. And then, of course, excuse me. There's the what we talked a lot about is that malware also uses Windows DLLs, and many of the IOCs that we've been talking about has to do with finding interesting DLLs that may not be that normal to use in legitimate programs, and see if there's malicious use of them. So this one should be obvious by now, that looking at the DLLs can give great insight, and that's why one of the first things we do, we start with the basic static analysis, and we look for the imports, and we see what DLLs are used by this program. And then there are the third thing is the third-party DLLs. Windows is not the only one that provides DLLs. One example, another browser like Firefox has DLLs. So if you see a program that uses a DLL from Firefox instead of Windows API for internet connection, then pursue that and see what it's used for. Wrong computer. I have too many computers. Next thing, way of transferring execution is through processes. So a process is basically a program that's executed by Windows. And it's a way of Windows to keep track of the resources, like handles and memory, that is allocated. So it can do this in a way without programs interfering with each other. A process can have one or more threads. We'll come into threads a little bit later. And malware can either run as a separate process or part of an existing process. And here's a shift. It used to be normal that they run as a separate process, but now we see that they're more and more integrated with the processes that are already running, hiding in things that we think should be there instead of starting a new process that is easier to detect. A little bit about the memory. So, like I said, its process is used to manage the resources, access to CPU, file system memory, and hardware. When it comes to memory, then it's you get an address range for each process. And just note that this can be the same. So if you have a memory address like this, this address can be used by multiple processes. Because the OS will keep track of where this is in physical memory, or maybe it's mapped over to the hard drive. So when a malware accesses this address, it only affects the process where it's that it's in. Did that all make sense? 32-bit executable gets 4 gigabyte of memory, and addressed the address, the actual addresses that you use might be the same, but where it is in the system may vary. Okay, how do we? What are the API calls to look for here? If you use create process, you can create a new process. It makes sense. So look for this. You have a lot of control when you start a new process, and that's why MalwareWriters like it. You can, for example, create a remote shell. There is something startup information that you need to provide. It contains handle to standard input output, and you can set this to a socket. So when the process has input output information, it goes to your remote location rather than somewhere locally. And this can then be used to make a really simple remote shell that sends the data wherever you want. There's an example from the book again, where the create process is used. Let's see if we can find it down here. So this is where the new process is created. Then the stack is initiated, and here the command line. That's where you get the program to start, and then you've already set up here. The error handling, the output, and the input. This is probably not visible when on the video, but these three lines. What you do is you set them equal to the socket, and the socket as the top. Shown all the way on the top there, has already been initiated earlier, so that doesn't show here. But in that first line, you have already set up a socket handle, the way we talked about earlier, and now you're feeding this in and saying every input and output should go to that socket, and then you create a process where you feed that information, and you're good to go. So your challenge here is to, when you see this, is to analyze and find out where the socket go. So we want to know where the input output is routed, and also the string here that is fed in here tells you what program is executed. So these are the two things that you need to see, figure out when you see this. Okay, we're starting a new process. What program are we starting? Follow this and follow this further in the code, and we see that there's a socket set up, so where does the information go? Don't get lost in all the other details. Good so far? All right, 2 minutes till 9, and I'll start on Threads, 9:15. All right. Yeah. Ok. 1, 2, 1, 2. Let's continue. I have to drink more coffee, or I need something stronger. What is 2 to the power of 32? Is it 4? Is it? I'm still not able to figure out if this is 4 gigabyte or 4 megabyte. But it's 2 to the power of 32 addresses that are we're able to address in a 32-bit system. So, yeah, okay. Sorry, my brain is not working today. There was a question in the break, so I'll just briefly repeat it for people online. It had to do with the addressing. See if this nice drawing here makes sense. When you have a program A and you execute it, it opens up a process A that can add, and it, there's reserved 4 gigabyte, 2 to the power of 32 address space for that program. And let's say you can address that space from 0 to whatever FFF something down there. When you open a program B, it initiates a process B that also gets 4 gigabyte of memory that can be addressed with the exact same addresses. So if you address, if you use this address here in process A, you end up here. If you address it in process B, you end up here. And if you're in this process, you cannot accidentally address process A. That's the that's what the OS makes sure that these processes are kept separate. But these 4 gigabytes and these 4 gigabytes, they have to be stored physically somewhere. And if this is the RAM, then maybe process A is up here and process B is down here. And if this is the hard drive, if you don't have 8 gigabytes of RAM and or even more, then part of this memory space is going to be put on the hard drive. And so even though these 4 gigabytes have the same address space here, the OS will keep track of where on the physical hard drive and RAM these program these data are actually put. But the process itself sees a very nice structure here, even though it can be fragmented like crazy by the OS. So that's just a little clarification on why that address can be reused in two processes without causing conflict. Hope that makes sense. Is there anything else that came up during the break? No. We'll continue. Okay, that was processes. Let's go and talk about threads. So the process is a container for execution. But each process can have one or more threads, and the threads are what the what is actually executed. And a thread is an independent sequence of instructions, so that follows and is taken one by one by the CPU. And a thread has the CPU's full attention. And threads in the same process share the same memory space. So this area here is unique for the process, but it's also shared by the threads. But they have their own registers and stack. There are, let me see if I understand you. There's only a fixed number of registers on the hardware, yes. AEX, and so forth, BX, and so forth. But they are shared. But I'll tell you what I'm coming to, why that statement still holds. I mean, it doesn't mean that they have their own dedicated registers, just that there are ways of them using the registers full out without interfering. And what we're doing, what we're using then is something called thread context. Because when a thread is running, it has complete control over the CPU and therefore also the registers and the stack. And another thread should not and cannot affect the CPU state, and the CPU state is also the stack and the registers. So when you switch from one thread to another, you need to save the CPU setting, and that is called the thread context. And then you load the context of the next thread. So you load the register and stack settings for the next thread. And the example in the book here is just a simple code here, where you use the LIA instruction and then a push. And this execution sequence here belongs to one thread. But it's possible to execute that instruction, save the thread context, execute whatever in a different thread in between here by loading that thread's context, then store that and load this thread's context again and continue with this instruction. You look like a question mark, but... So one thread would have a long sequence of assembly instructions to execute. Here is a given example with two. But the OS can decide, or the process can decide that thread number two, for some reason, needs to execute something anywhere in the sequence. So when it reaches a point where it says another thread needs the CPU's attention, it saves all the CPU values. So registers, stack, loads the same values for the other thread. And then you're over here in a different sequence of instructions and you execute that and you come to a point, you're saying we need to give the CPU back to the other thread. So then you save the state, you load the state that you had here, and then thread number one continues with this. So it's only one thread that controls the CPU at the time, but when it does, it has complete control. But you can switch between threads by saving and loading thread context or the state of the CPU. So what does the malicious guys do? Well, of course, you can use the create thread function to create a new thread, specify a starting address or a start function. This can be used to launch a malicious DLL in the middle of a process. There's also an example in the book. You can look closer where you use two threads, one for input and one for output, to get communication with the running program. So when the malware starts to create new threads, you need to find out what is this used for. Because that means that it's jumping to a different section of code, doing something else, and then maybe returning. I think I mentioned mutex before. It's called mutant if you talk about it in the kernel, but we're not going to go there, at least not yet. These are global objects, and they are there to coordinate between processes and threads. And they coordinate the access to shared resources. So the thread context stores the registers in the stack, but the memory, so what I've written here, is shared. So several threads can write different places in here. Then you can use mutexes to make sure that this is not that this is done correctly. There's only one thread that can own a mutex at a time, and these mutexes are often given hard-coded names. The reason for this, for malware writers, is that they want to they want to prevent multiple infections. So they want to make sure that when they arrive a new computer that it's not been infected already. And then the name, if they're going to use mutexes to check that, then they need to know what the name is. Then it needs to be a name that is universal recognizable, so does not change. That's why these names are hard-coded or static. And if you find one, it's a really good both signature but also indicator of compromise. Instructions to look for: wait for single object that gives the thread access to the mutex, and if thread asks for access while it's busy, it must wait until the thread releases the mutex. Then you have other instructions like create mutex or open a handle to existing one. And the typical use is to try to open a mutex with the name that you're looking for. If you get a yes, then it's already infected. If you get a no, then you use create mutex and you infect the computer the first time. And then the next time you'll get yes. There's an example in the book where the hard-coded name is HGL345. And we see that name, we recognize that name there. These are the values, input values to the function put on the stack. And we recognize hard-coded name here. We call open mutex. And then there's a test to see if it's there or not. And if it's not, if it doesn't find that mutex, then finally it calls the create mutex. If it finds it, then it jumps out. So this is a typical use of mutexes. And then it's, of course, the trick here is to recognize and find that name and then use that in your signatures. So that was mutex. Services. There's a lot of finer small differences here, but service is something that run in the background. You have it several on your computer. They run without user interaction. Some might run at certain times. They might not run all the time. And they are scheduled by Windows Service Manager. The malware writers, this has some benefits for the malware writers. Very often the services run as system or admin, but if they run as system, they have more, written more powerful, but they mean they have a more privileges than admin. It also is possible to create persistence with services, make them start with the OS or start at a certain time, and sometimes they're often not visible if you open the task manager. The autoruns tool, if you try that, should be able to view them. So what to look for? Open SC Manager. That API call would open a handle to the service control manager. So then you know something's going on with services. Create service adds a new service where you can specify if it starts at boot or if it starts manually. Will be interesting to see if it starts at boot. They could have created persistence. And then start service is how you start it up if you chose manual in the create process. Different types: Win32 share processes, most common. You have the code for this is stored in a DLL. And I'm sure you've seen on your computer the svchost.exe. This is a service running that actually contains several different services under the same same instance or same name. You also have other types of services, Win32 own process, that is stored as an EXE, and then you have something called kernel driver that loads the code into the kernel. Information about the services can be found in the registry listed here. HKLM system current control set services, and if you look up here, it says image path Windows System 32, and then I can't read it here, but it should be visible in your book or vmnut.exe. So since it's an exe, then we know it's of this type. Start value right here. You need to look up, but this value means auto start. And yeah, here is the type. I could have we could have read it out here too. Win32 own process. So again, if you see these function used, you might want to look into what services are started and what are they used what's their purpose. Questions? Next one, component object model. Another way of transferring execution. This is a standard interface where different software components can communicate in a standardized way, so you don't need the detailed information about each other. You just know that, hey, we're following the standard. That means we can reuse software components. It makes sense from that side. For the malware analyst, if you see this use, then you need to try to figure out what code is run by the function call. This also has a server client structure, where the client is the one using the COM object and the server is the one that hosts the reusable software components. So, some code that is common interest to other programs provided by the server, and then the client can call them and reuse that whenever needed. Every thread that uses the COM call, this is worth noticing, these two API calls, OLE initiate and CO initialize, is what you need to look for, because then this is in use. And then there's a way of addressing this, which can be a little bit complicated to look at the first time, but you have global unique identifiers of two types. Class identifier, where you find that in this register key, and the interface identifiers that you find in these keys. And please look at the book or a different source for more details if you run across this. And then we'll see what malware use, because some malware use this to implement a server. They want to offer some functions to other programs. There is something called browser helper objects as a third-party plugins for Internet Explorer, as an example. There are no restrictions on this, and you can run the code inside Internet Explorer, either to monitor internet traffic, track browser usage or command and control. If you set up a server for this, then it's usually easy to detect, because you'll see something that exports several functions, and you already know that normal program imports a lot. If it exports a lot, then it's either a DLL or something suspicious is going on. So if you have written down here several IOCs, if you see these, then you might suspect that a COM server is put up, and then it's worth looking into what it's doing. Not a popular way of but at least not unheard of way of transferring execution is to exploit the exception handling when something goes wrong on your computer or in the program. So something happens, division by zero or some other error, we need a way of handling that, so we don't just lock the entire computer. So when these exceptions occur, we execute, we move the execution to a special routine, and then these exceptions are handled by different instances. And the structure exception handling, which this refers to, is Windows mechanisms for handling exception, and it's implemented on the stack in a nested way. So you have this one, and this is worth noticing, the IOC FS0. This points to the beginning of the exception handling stack, and so that's where you start, and then if the first can't handle it, it's passed on. But if you see program that either use or manipulate this, then something's going on with the exception handling stack and or the structure exception handling. So find out what it is. And if this can't resolve it, then other mechanisms will take over or eventually give you the blue screen. So, of course, we have malicious use of this too. There are exploits that overwrite the exception handling stack. So you can and you can do this by buffer overflow. What you want to do then, what the malware is trying to do, is to create an exception, for example, division by zero. And then the execution is handed over to SEH. And then if you inserted your own code there, then you can decide what happens. And this, if you don't know where to look, then this is a great way of hiding your code. No questions? No. Very briefly, kernel versus user mode. Not an in-depth presentation, but just a brief look. We'll see if we get back to this later. But for now, Windows run in two modes, user mode and kernel mode. Most, almost all programs run in the user mode. Where each process then is given the resources and permission it needs. And like we just saw, if it crashes, it's handled by Windows. It cannot access resources directly. And something we haven't mentioned yet, but it has not full use of CPU registers and instructions. So there are limitations on what you can do in what a program can do in user mode. Then you have a kernel mode, the lower level, where the operating systems and drivers run. This is different. When we talk about the processes, threads, and sharing resources, we're talking user mode. In kernel mode, everything is shared and handled in different ways. And a crash, if you crash here, it's not handled by the operating system, and you get this blue screen of death that is so popular. Hardware can be accessed directly. A little bit more. Code running in the lower kernel mode can manipulate the user mode code, but not vice versa. And also, the kernel mode is not logged. So you can imagine that this is a popular place to be for malware, because you have greater potential. If you get to write malware that runs in kernel mode, you have more options, you can create more damage, and you're more stealthy than if you run in user mode. There is a catch, though. It is much more difficult, and if you mess something up, then you really mess up the computer, and it's very visible that something went wrong. If a malware crashes on or doesn't work properly in user mode, there are mechanisms that can handle it and hide it, so it's not obvious to the user. But if you do something wrong here, the computer doesn't work. So that was briefly about that, and this is related. The native API topic of today is Windows API, and this is what will one of the last slides. On top here you have user application. Then you have a number of DLLs. This in this figure we mentioned one, kernel 32. And normally, when a user application wants to use API function, they find them in DLLs at this level. That you import the DLL and then you have these functions available. But these functions cannot work directly on the hardware, so they again use ntdll.dll, which is called the native API. And these are low-level functions that normal users shouldn't have access to. And then these make the requests down to kernel mode and get things done. That is how it's implemented. But there is nothing that prevents anyone from using these function calls directly. So if you know about these function calls, you can call them as you like. largely undocumented, I've written that in Windows. They don't want you to know about this because they want you to use these functions. And so if you follow the normal way of implementing programs, you should use these functions and not these. And legitimate programs will probably follow that, but here are opportunities for the malicious people. They can freely use these as they want. There are in the book a couple of links to places where documentation for this is found, because people have been trying and by trial and error found out how these works eventually. The benefit of this for the malware writer is that you get new opportunities. There are functions down here that gives you access to things that these won't do, and also you're able to hide from at least naive security programs. This might be different now, but if you implement a security program that monitors between the user application and the functions you call, and the application doesn't use these functions but bypasses these DLLs and use the native API instead, then the security program won't detect it. I'm sure that since 2012 and maybe even back there are better security programs that would actually detect this, but for the naive programs, or this is at least an attempt to hide a little bit better. So what to look for? Again, these are things, if you see these, NT-read file, write file, or query system information, information about processes, information about threads, information about file, keys, then I might be legitimate, but I might not. So look into that. NT-continue is also something that can be used to return from exceptions. And the thing here is that where you return can be altered or manipulated. So this can be used to confuse you. Look, there's not enough to get confused about. They add more. And the whole idea here is to confuse you so you use more time on the analysis, or confuse you so much that you don't understand what's going on. That won't happen to you, of course. But last note, the prefix NT, there's a prefix ZW. There are tiny differences apparently in at the kernel level, but nothing that either you or the malware writers should worry about. They're pretty much the same. And that was it. That was chapter 7. Easy, right? The whole point here is to give you, I hope I've given you an overview, and when you read the chapter, you get an overview of the terminology and a lot of the API function calls that that are used in Windows for both good and bad. And you know that if you see this combination, okay, this is what goes on and I can ignore it, or I need to pursue it. That's the whole point. Get the high level picture of what's going on, and use your efforts where it's needed. All right, any questions? Any questions online? And as usual, I'll be online until noon. Try to answer questions on the chat. And final slide. There's a lab, 7.1, 7.2, and 7.3 for this chapter. Sergey told me that 7.3, lab 7.3, only works in XP mode. So if you haven't implemented that or taken care of that on your computer, then you might struggle with 7.3. And then, of course, there's always the opportunity to continue on the assignment now that you know what file to file to use. So let me just repeat that if there are new listeners. The assignment, Kato showed you how to get to a dropper. That dropper contains some malware, and it will drop it as a dropped file that actually contains the malware that will do the bad stuff. That dropped file, even though we ask you in the first question to drop it, to get it to show itself, you don't have to analyze this for assignment one. What you need to analyze for assignment one is the dropper itself. So the PE file that Kato showed you how to get to. If you want to repeat what he did, or if you want to start looking at the dropped file, the actual malicious code, please feel free to do so. I won't stop students from doing too much. That's but the focus is up here. So try to show me in the report that you understand basic dynamic and static analysis on that file, and that you understand how to use IDAPRO and recognizing the IOCs that Kato mentioned. Try to find them and document it in a way that I understand. Now is your time to teach me. So if there are any other questions about the assignment, then don't hesitate to contact me. the teaching assistant, or even better, if it's very technical, I provided the email directly to Kato. No questions online and none in the classroom. Next Monday is my Winterferie, winter holiday. So that Monday, there won't be any lecture. But as somebody pointed out, that's a good time to start or finish the the assignment. So then you have some hours there. And then you hand it in on Monday at 23:59, I think I wrote. And then the first lecture after after the winter holiday is, I believe it's Chapter 8, Advanced Dynamic Analysis. And that will be Sergei Banin, my teaching assistant, that will teach you that, using Olli Debug to step through code is what that is about. Okay, good luck.